It all came as a sudden surge of salt water that my father didn't see nor sense. A colossus of gravitational motion, plankton, and regurgitated continent that swept through his legs and left him off balance and suspended, hanging precariously by one hand to a cleft of the high, cavernous seawall. His body was pummeled in cascading seawater that heaved onto the rocks with a peculiar vengeance reserved for things unknown and unimagined. Yet in this ferocity, my father seemed to linger in animation, cocooned in a bubble of despair, perched between land and sea. The land and sea were at odds here and met at a point that was jagged and sheared. Ragged plateaus of continent plunged and tides frothed in torrents of energy. Land erupted from surf, jutting upward and outward in patterns of headlands, groves, rivers, and ravines. Here, a geology of sand and water were bound to timeless erosion. Nearby, a seagull with a mangled leg hopped along the shoreline. It hobbled tentatively 1, 2, 3, 4 times and then stopped to rest. It lingered defeated before making a final effort to rise towards the cliff in a flap of wings. It pushed and pushed until a gust took it outward toward the breakers and set it against a rip curl where it was lost to turbulence. Nearby, a low, uncertain fog emerged, engulfing all in that same curious vapor that had plagued mariners, Spaniards, viceroys, gold miners, saloon owners, dairy ranchers, homesteaders, farmers, crabbers, railroad barons, Chinese laborers, longshoremen for centuries and would for centuries to come. It was a fog that wrested superstition from logic and knowledge from mysticism. Vague phantoms lived there, supernaturals that questioned all fate and all existence with one anonymous sweep of dew and moisture. And it was amidst this landscape that my father's face grimaced upward, eyes seething and then softening in pure atonement for anything and everything. That rogue wave retreated, of course, as rogue waves do, and in so doing left my father hyperventilating, coughing, dripping, and grabbing at firmament. Around him, pools of sea foam emerged in craggy rocks that revealed clouds of seaweed, starfish, brittlefish, sand dollars, anemones, and minnows of all species. There were broken pieces of the blue plastic tackle box, and floating about were No. 6 hooks, gray and red bobbers of various sizes, plastic bags, rusty pliers, even day-old night crawlers that slowly freed themselves from a styrofoam universe of wood chips and potting soil, lead sinkers, pink Tillamook salmon eggs that tasted like fish vomit if you were dared to eat one, and the waterlogged Wonder Bread remnants of my father's pickle and hot dog sandwich. These things swirled at his feet in a chaotic constellation of beauty. My father bellowed curse words and shrieks and hollers to me, to the sky, to anything in earshot. He clung to that cliff and called out in throaty cries of exasperation until his vocal cords became raspy and weak and nearly gave out. He hung silent for quite some time as the storm approached and the winds picked up. The temperature cooled. My father's eyes closed and his entire disposition seemed to become completely resigned. He hung there lifeless, unfeeling, unknowing. And then suddenly he started calling out again. Calling out, only not calling out in that ordinary language as before. No, in this moment of desperation, he used that other language, the one that had been made up very long before, the one that was part of us, our tectonics, our ocean, our waves, our fury, our chaos, our secret language that existed solely between he and I in our moments of despair. It was the language of us. A nonsensical, nonverbal, primordial codex of interpretations, of sighs, and of skeletal motions that pushed us towards each other. And because this interpretation is merely a relative of imagination, it was for us as close to communion in father and son as we could get. And in this language I lifted my father in words of us. I lifted him just as he let out invisible sentences of anger and exasperation and love. He grappled hand over hand up the trail until he stood again atop the sea ledge, where he had been before as a solitary fisherman casting in repetition into a curtain of foam and spray. I had been watching all this from the sandy bluff near the road. From there, I could see the entire inlet, from the river mouth to the bridge spanning the peninsula, and toward the town lights that flickered in twilight. Buildings were small rectangles and squares and indistinct gray shapes. Station wagons and Cadillacs cruised the line of knick-knack shops, sputtering from crosswalk to crosswalk. At the top of the hill, the rustic church sat in a eucalyptus grove. Below the city, the river emptied into the bay, and a sturgeon trawler with engine trouble was pitching side to side in the sing-song rhythm of the waves. The crew wore yellow rubber overalls over flannel shirts with sleeves rolled to their elbows. They stared into the headlands as their legs dangled over the stern. The fog closed in around them, closing in, until the small buffeting waves became stronger and grayer and merged into the collapsing shore. This was the water that dripped through my father's hair and ran pink with the blood from the gash over his eye. He pulled himself up, dripping, then hobbled up the sandy trail to where I was. He was limp and embarrassed. He didn't look at me but ran two fingers through the gash above his eye and then pulled them away to examine the blood. His hair was pressed against his forehead and his turtleneck hung waterlogged. His slacks were dry just in the inseams, and as he walked, water bubbled from the heels of his boots. When he finally spoke, it was as if the waves were still crashing through him, thrashing his lungs. "God damn," he whispered in a quiet, bare voice. "I've lost my glasses." He turned slowly toward the incoming tide and the harbor buoy and the disabled trawler, and he looked at me pleadingly. "Paul, be a good kid and run down there and fish him out, would you?" And fearing the fury of one, yet loathing the wrath of the other, I did exactly as my father asked me. We were on the coast for my grandmother's funeral. It didn't feel so much of a funeral, I suppose, as something of a hereditary rummage sale, a bereavement of things dispossessed by a relative who hadn't been much more than a discarded footnote of mention in my life to that point. My older brother Clayton and I had never given our grandmother much thought, and we had supposed our father had done the same. We had never met her, never been visited by her, never been called by her on a birthday or even received a Christmas card from her. She was not mentioned in our house or referred to, and therefore our concept of genealogy ran from my father to Clayton and me and back again. It was through a phone call we learned that this mysterious grandmother Tilda Gottlieb had passed away of pancreatic cancer in her home on the Northern California coast, just north of San Francisco. This happened a few days before Thanksgiving. And since her funeral coincided with the school vacation, Clayton and I went along for the drive to Tilda's home to meet relatives previously unknown and stay a few days. Her house sat on a bluff overlooking the hills filled with giant redwood trees. It was a very large three-story Victorian with odd dimensions, as if it had been constantly remodeled over the decades. Clayton and I spent the nights camped out in sleeping bags, as there were no sheets to be found, in a spare bedroom that smelled of mildew and bug traps. We spent the hours exploring the oddities of the estate, wandering the home's enigmatic nooks, the dim hallways, and its rambling sense of architecture. It was a creaky, old-fashioned edifice with narrow passageways, sagging stairwells, toilets with pull cords from the ceiling, pipes that rattled with cold well water, ceilings that creaked, windows with rotted sills, bedrooms with faded paisley wallpaper, and a living room floor that pitched to one side, unnaturally, as if a foundation block had long given way and the entire home had resigned itself to a curious list. But odder still was the educational-themed clutter the old woman had hoarded to fill nearly every inch of floor and closet space. For much of her life, Tilda had been a grade school teacher and over the years had collected all manner of things related to the classroom. Bedrooms were filled with boxes of children's books, spelling quizzes, rulers, paste, light brights, paints, Crayola sets, board games, music stands, rolling chalkboards, erasers, and dry aquariums filled with tiny rocks and plastic castles. One room had a menagerie of child-sized desks, perfectly aligned into rows, as if Tilda had held court there on weekends or during summers. All the walls seemed to have scuff marks and handprints at just about the height of the light switches, and many appeared fresh enough to have been placed just days or weeks before. Once or twice at night, Clayton and I bolted upright in our sleeping bags, thinking we could indeed hear the tiny patters of feet running back and forth through the halls and rooms. And then there were all those photographs. Photographs and more photographs. Entire hallways covered floor to ceiling with photographs. Copious black and white pictures of children she had not reared but for whom she had invested years of devotion to. It was as if the pages of some school yearbook had been blown up and folded over. Some images were framed, others were tucked inside and hung dustily against another. Some revealed the progression of the same face through different grade levels, growing, developing, and changing in demeanor and physique. Closer to Tilda's bedroom, the photos became more personal, with faces of relatives of unknown origin, cousins and nephews of vague resemblance to my father. And finally, there was one revealing Tilda herself, encased in a wooden frame, and I saw my father examine this for quite some time. It was the first time I'd ever seen a picture of my grandmother, taken perhaps earlier in her life when she must have been in her 20s. She wore an elegant patterned blouse with a winter skirt, and in the background it looked to be a holiday party. She was robin-faced with supple cheekbones that were youthful in texture and plumpness. Her eyes resembled my father's, dark and unyielding, and yet intelligent and captivating in intensity. Her hair was more like my brother's than mine, darker, wavier. Her lips existed as two permanently puckered indentations. One pallid arm was poised on her hip, and the other elbowed into her side. Her hand was flayed back with a half-burnt cigarette in two fingers. From her hips, her body followed two vertical lines along her skirt, revealing two full calves, pasty and muscular. Her overall poise looked gleeful yet surprised, as if caught in the shutter unexpectedly by someone she didn't know. My father drank the image bitterly, as if it were a dry whiskey. "There's you," my father said to no one. "And there's all these here kids, but there isn't a single picture of me." He then saw me in the hallway and said, "Families are such drastically hard things, Paul." That night, the guests arrived in intervals, pulling their station wagons into the gravel drive one by one and parking in the grassy backyard. Many were ex-students, some quite still young, some grown to adulthood. Some were former co-workers, churchgoers, or long-standing friends of Tilda's, and some were local politicians, from the postmaster to a city councilman, to the head of the local Elks Club. All had heard of my grandmother's passing and had decided to pop by to say hello to anyone who might be there. Once arrived, they stayed a while and then a while longer. Some even stayed for dinner. They greeted each other in animated voices and said things like, "I haven't seen you since Darlene's graduation." Or, "Just look at your Stephen. I bet he's grown a foot since summer." Or, my, look who's looking like a rose in a petunia garden." Some would hug and kiss each other on the cheeks and run fingers through hair, while others would slap each other on the back and pull at a pair of suspenders. We would meet them on the landing of Tilda's porch, and their tones would suddenly change and grow solemn. "You must be that side of the family," they would say. We would nod and smile. They would pass us with heads lowered until they were through the door, where their voices would rise again, chirping and laughing. "They had no idea who the hell we were," my father said. Despite the oddity of it all, I enjoyed the evening meal, as it was certainly better than anything we had had in quite a bit. Our Uncle Casey was the head cook. Clayton and I had only met him once or twice before and only knew very little about him. Not even what he did or where he lived. But that night we knew that Uncle Casey was keeping fastidious watch over a massive turkey filled with bread stuffing and gravy that slowly browned in rich juices in Tilda's General Electric oven. Many of the other visitors had brought something to eat or drink, and those that hadn't helped stir pots, ladle broths, or chop something or another on cutting boards. There were green beans and mushrooms, sweet yams, mashed potatoes, cranberry jellies, cornbreads, real ham, black olives, green olives with pimentos, other types of pickles, sweet and vlasic, red potato salads, jello salads, trays of mixed nuts, And of course, different colored wines and all forms of pies, from pumpkin to pecan to lemon meringue. When all was ready, we sat at an enormous makeshift table that had been fashioned from various card tables, classroom desks, and even cardboard boxes. People talked briskly about where one another had come from and what they did for a living. There were questions for Clayton and I about how old we were and what grades and so forth. Then the conversation turned to local stories and news of the area. A fisherman who had lost his boat in a bad game of gin rummy. An oil artist who opened a new gallery and then had it destroyed in a suspicious fire. The three Hell's Angels who lived in the farmhouse near Albion and who now grew alpacas and sold fur. And a sheriff's deputy who had been found just yesterday passed out drunk in his patrol car at a stoplight. Things of this sort. And at times they talked about Tilda, about her kindness and her gratitude during her cancer. My father listened courteously, but said little, looking anxiously about the table and filling his wine glass again and again and yet again. When dinner was finished and all the pies had been sliced and eaten, a tired sobriety swept into the room with the slumbering nature of the fog that crept into the bay. The faces of the visitors seemed deflated, as if they had suddenly collectively realized something about their surroundings and the people around them that embarrassed them. They rose and departed one at a time, as people like that do, in a swoon of winded pleasantries and half-smiles. Later, only my father and our Uncle Casey were left at the table while Clayton and I did dishes in the kitchen. Our uncle was the executor of the will, and my father talked to him slowly and sedately over cups of Kahlua and coffee, and then finally shots of something that smelled horrendous and was poured savoringly from an old-fashioned-looking bottle. They hadn't spoken to each other for a very long time, and when they were done talking about money and property, they moved to the many things that had transpired over the years. At times, one would get up from the table to pick a 45 from Tilda's collection and set it on the record player. It chirped old jazz tunes with saxophones and trumpets at low volumes as Clayton and I slipped into our sleeping bags in the guest room and turned down the lights. The window was cracked open and we could hear the foghorn bellow as a chilly wind disturbed the curtains. We heard the front doors open and shut and the sounds of my father and his brother suddenly outside gurgling from a new bottle, their feet stumbling along the gravel toward the ocean and into the vague moonlit landscape. The next day, many of the same people from the dinner came to the little church on the hill that overlooked the city for the funeral. My father was a pallbearer. Clayton and I sat with him in the first row near the pulpit and just shy of the rows of scented candles. Tilda's casket rested just feet away, made of mahogany with silver amulets and golden tassels of decoration. The priest wore a dark purple set of robes and caressed each pew with a billowing vat of incense before reading lugubriously from a passage in Matthew about a wide net that would be cast into the water and of fish that would be brought ashore. Some of the fish would be kept, but others would be cast aside. When the priest was finished talking about the nets and fish, he doused the casket with more incense, and everyone stood and sang a hymn, except my father, who remained seated with his eyes closed. He was not Catholic like our mother, and had long said churches made him feel claustrophobic. After the service, people funneled out and crossed the paved road into the rugged, rock-strewn cemetery where my father helped lower the casket into the dirt void. The priest said a few more things about salvation and reflection, and the entire time my father just stared into the gaping pit. When all this was over, people were beginning to dissipate. Someone finally asked about our mother. It was a question that took my father off guard. He replied simply, "She's been quite ill." It was close enough to the truth. Later, my father drove home on Sunday with our old Dodge Dart pulling us sideways and forwards and sideways again as the roadway meandered through the coastal hills. He dialed the Raiders game on an AM station, and the reception came and went. When it faded in, the wild voice of Bill King bounded from the speakers out against the windows, over the seats, and back again with the frantic madness of a trapped deer. "Stabler back, finds Branch. Crossing in the end zone, touchdown! Holy Toledo!" The road unwound into the valley, where the air became warmer and smelled of cut grass and fertilizer. Cars moved faster. Gray puffs of clouds hung in the distance over the Sierra, where it had been snowing earlier. My father turned to an FM station, and the music made the speaker fabric dance in vibrations. He turned up the volume as Springsteen wailed, "I want to die with you, Wendy, on the streets tonight in an everlasting kiss." My father sang along with beads of sweat gathering in his forehead, eyes closed, arms motioning, knees balancing against the wheel. In the mountain foothills, my father pulled off the freeway and idled the car at the start of a long, sloping road that led to our house. He glanced back at me in the rearview mirror and then over to my brother. His mind seemed to mull something that had just overtaken him, and he shook his head for a moment. "That old bird left it all to me," he whispered. He took a half-burnt cigarette from his pocket and lit it again, his deep inhale making the tobacco crackle. He smoked this way for several moments until he seemed to realize that he had spoken something that he shouldn't. He stiffened and wagged a finger at us. "Now don't tell your mother a goddamn thing," he exhaled, a tobacco cloud.